This podcast is a presentation of UCTV.tv, University of California Television. Like what you learn? Help others discover UCTV podcasts by leaving a comment or rating in iTunes. Also, make sure to check out and subscribe to our YouTube original channel, UCTV Prime, available only on YouTube at youtube.com/UCTV Prime. This UCTV podcast is sponsored in part by Audible.com, your destination for the widest selection of digital audiobooks available, including many by guests you've heard here on UCTV. Audible.com is offering UCTV podcast listeners a free 30-day trial subscription and one free audiobook download. Just visit audibletrial.com/UCTV to sign up. That's audibletrial.com/UCTV. And thanks.
I wanted to take some time and talk about the pediatrician's role in identifying children who would benefit from early start services, and really focusing on the 0 to 3 children. There's a feeling out there. There's a lot of reasons, but I think it's good to ask the question: but aren't we catching them all early? You know, the CDC has come out a number of times, and I think these numbers are a little bit on the lower side now, particularly with the new data with prevalence of autism, that the CDC reports that about 16-18% of all children have a challenge in the areas of speech and language, intellectual disability, learning disabilities, and emotional behavioral disturbances. That would all benefit from early identification and treatment. Many of those can be served through early start. Only about 20 or 30% of children are detected prior to school entry, and that's 5 to 6 years of age. So only about 3 to 8% are being served in the early intervention program, and that's not as a function of them not being available, but really being able to identify and refer these children. So the under-enrollment rates are roughly around 80%. We do know for every dollar spent on early intervention, there have been a number of studies that has said if we spend a dollar in that 0 to 3, and that can be universal preschool, it can be early start services, but we're looking at about a $13 return on their investment over the lifetime of that child. The AAP came out with a policy statement in 2006 saying that early identification of developmental disorders is critical to the well-being of the child. It's an integral function of the pediatrician and their primary care medical home to work to identify these families and support these families. Early detection should be performed at all well-child visits from infancy through school age and any age thereafter if concerns are raised. Developmental, this is a difference, I think, when it came out, that developmental surveillance should be performed at every well-child visit, and I would say any time you have contact with the child. And routine developmental screening, specific screening, should occur at 9, 18, and 24 and 30 months. There's this really confusing figure that they have. It actually requires a screen this big to actually figure it all out. But it's actually a nice algorithm. It's very clear and provides breakpoints in which for the individual in the office to know when to screen, when to do surveillance, and when to make referrals, and what to do after a referral has been made in terms of follow-up for that child and medical evaluations after that. So I think it's an important paper to and policy to review. It made a distinction between surveillance, which I think all of us feel that we do, and screening. Surveillance is a process of just observing, recognizing children who may be at risk for developmental delays. So it can be, there's an active portion of that, there's a passive portion of that, but it's generally just engaging the child and the family to ascertain whether there are concerns or if you see concerns. Now, screening is using a standardized instrument that has been validated and provides data to act upon. Whether that's a child that's at risk or in the monitoring range, or a child that really is showing a level of delay that should and indicates a referral to early start services in this age group. So I wanted to go over developmental surveillance because there are specifically five components of that, and many times it's like, well, he looks pretty good, or yeah, he walked in here on his own locomotion, so he's fine. But it's really a fun part of this, and you can get, and I'm going to give you some specific tools that I found fun in doing this, but it's really in five components: eliciting and attending to the parent's concerns, documenting and maintaining developmental histories, making accurate observations, identifying risks and protective factors, and maintaining kind of an accurate record that we're all required to do in documenting the process. Now, eliciting and attending to the parents' concerns. This oftentimes, I think it's a time which, as a general pediatrician at a well child visit, it's a great opportunity to say, "Mom, Dad, please brag about your child. What is your child doing right now? What are they learning in these sort of areas? What is exciting you about their child's language?" And it's a nice way to introduce this conversation, because you're really looking for the strengths of the child instead of saying, in the back half, do you have any concerns? No? Okay, let's move forward. So it gives an open-ended start to the conversation of what's exciting you. And then asking if there are anything that's particularly challenging in parenting this child or the child is facing in terms of their development. And then finally, any concerns that they have. So you've started that thinking process of what they're doing, and you know what? Maybe I am concerned about how my child is developing language. You want to document some of the things that are progressing over that child's development. So have you seen, what changes have you seen since our last visit? Have there been, I think a targeted question that's quite good, has your child lost any skills, or has your child gone backwards or in their development? I think that's a red flag for many different things, whether it be autism or other physical kind of medical conditions. Making accurate observations. This is the really fun part. Gives you a chance to write off buying a bunch of toys at your local toy store. Because you're bringing them in, you're actually playing with the kid, you're actually interacting with the child, seeing how the child and their parents interact. And really just... That's the reason we went into pediatrics. That's why we chose to work with children. We get a chance to play with them, and you can get a lot of information about that. It also makes it a little bit easier when they're coming in with an ear infection. If you played with them before, you can sort of play with them and get in to see their ear, and they're not so fearful. But really sort of documenting those observations is the other part of it. Identifying what the risk factors are for things that are actually to look out for. So Lynn Abbadudo mentioned research at the Mind about, well, if a family comes to you and you're seeing a 9-month-old and there are two other children in the family with autism, that would change the dynamic of that appointment and really be drilling down to see if there's any early risk factors for that child to show signs and symptoms of autism. Are there, in the family history, are there genetic? Is there three cousins with intellectual disability and all boys? Or are there, just the demographics and the social challenges that are being faced by that family? Have they just been foreclosed on their home and those types of things, and they can lead to adverse child experiences? And it's ironic that the same things on the left that are known to be risks are also things that are known to be protective. You can comment on those in both a positive and negative way, much in the way Len said. We have challenges, but we have ways of facing them. So keeping documentation, I hate telling people that because I hate documentation, but it's important. So what if your family does have a concern? It's important to ask yourself, what is your response? My child is not talking, and he's 18 months old, and other kids around him are actually starting to really start to use words, and I'm worried. Do you find yourself as a practitioner kind of reassuring the family because you're unsure of the next step? This is a great question, because if you do find yourself you're not sure what to do as the next step, we can help you with those next steps. And also, you can find information about here today about how would you make a referral, or what would your next step be in terms of screening. Do you instantly refer? Oops, speech delay, I'm just going to refer. So I think there are places for that are important, we'll find more about these referral sources. And do you discuss screening? So do you send the family home with a screening tool, maybe work on it, and then schedule a follow-up visit at another appointment? Or have you built sort of a infrastructure in your clinic group to handle these types of questions? So the screening is to be used whenever there is a concern, but also at these scheduled well-child visits. Now, there's two examples of screening tools I wanted to share with you. The Ages and Stages questionnaire. The ASQ-3 is readily available. The Infant Toddler Checklist is a free tool, and the MCHAT's a free tool. I'll give you the links of those here. The CDC Act Early site is a really wonderful site for finding out information on screening tools, as well as the current data and also the current state of the and handouts for developmental milestones. First Signs is a link to get some of these screening tools. 0 to 3 is a wonderful place to get help, resources for your families. And then Bricks Publishing, they provide the infant toddler checklist free of charge to use in your clinic. The ASQ-3 comes with a nominal price. So as we move through all of the folks that are talking about the Early Start services, I want you to think about this child that might come to your clinic, might be, I sort of focus this doctor-centered, but I want everyone who touches a child's life, you might have a neighbor that comes to you and says, God, my son is has really bad tantrums, and when he gets so mad at times, he just bangs his head really hard. It could be, doctor, help me, neighbor, help me, daycare worker, help me, preschool, and also regional center, school, and Warmline, you can always call to help those as well. So think about this child when we're hearing about them. We'll come back to that.
My name is Ellen Wright, and I'm one of the early intervention supervisors at Alta California Regional Center. And I'm going to give you just a brief sort of general overview about Early Start at the Regional Center, the kids that we serve, the services that we provide, and how to make referrals. And Dr. Nowicki did a great job of giving that overview of if you're a pediatrician or even just someone out in the community who has a concern about a child, how to identify that concern, and then what to do next is what we're going to kind of go from here. The Regional Center, and our acronym there is ACRC, it's Alta California Regional Center. We serve in our Early Start program all infants and toddlers ages birth to 36 months. And the Early Start program, as Gina mentioned in the introduction, is based on the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, or Part C as we call it. And it was really put into place in 1993 to enhance the development of at-risk infants and children and prevent the need for special education services when that child turns 3 and enters the school district and starts preschool. We have two categories of eligibility that I wanted to go over, and they have changed. For those of you who've been around for a while, in 2009, our eligibility criteria changed, and so I want to go over those changes to make sure that you're clear on exactly who we serve in our Early Start program. The first category is developmental delay, and the second category is established risk, and we're going to talk about that in a little bit more detail. Our developmental delay criteria, it did change in 2009. It got a little bit more tighter on the criteria. Prior to 2009, if a child was referred to the regional center with a concern about developmental delay, they had to have a 33% delay in their development. In 2009, the eligibility criteria tightened up a little bit. If a child is referred under the age of 24 months, it still is that they have to have a 33% in an area of their development. However, if they're referred to the regional center after the age of 24 months, they have to have one 50% delay or two 33% delays. So it's a little bit more stricter as the child gets older. The areas of development that we're looking at when we're establishing eligibility under the developmental delay criteria are listed here. Cognitive, communication, which includes expressive and receptive language, social and emotional, adaptive, and physical. So those are the categories of development that we are looking at when we're assessing our kids for eligibility. The second category of eligibility for early start at the regional center is established risk conditions, and those are conditions that we know have a high probability of resulting in a developmental delay. And typically the kids that fall into those categories are children with genetic or congenital conditions. The most common that we serve in this category are infants and toddlers with Down syndrome. And how we're handling established risk at the regional center, we actually have a team that meets every Monday, and we review referrals with our physician on staff and our nurse and our early intervention supervisors to determine whether a child might fall into this category. The category of eligibility that was eliminated in 2009 were our high-risk infants and toddlers, so we are reviewing all of those to see if some of those kids might actually fall into the established risk category. So we're trying to catch them when we can. Referrals to the regional center, we take referrals from everyone, and we get calls, we get faxes, we get them from parents, family members, neighbors. We get a lot of referrals from pediatricians and physicians in the community. We work really closely with our public health department. Children's Protective Services also makes referrals to us. We get referrals from our local education agencies, family resource centers, early Head Start. We're pretty open to who can make a referral to the regional center, and we always encourage people to make that referral. Our services are voluntary, so we will contact the family to see if they are interested in our services, but we definitely encourage the community to make that initial referral, and we will follow up with the family. Early intervention services are provided based on the developmental needs of the child and the concerns and the priorities of the family, and also the resources that are already available to that child and family. And services are provided within the context of the child's family and the child and family's daily activities and routines. And this is something that has been in place since Early Start came into play, but we're really trying to make a concerted effort to shift back to providing services in that family's natural environment, talking to that family about that child and family's daily routines and activities, and provide those services that really make sense to them, and not deliver those services in a clinic setting with the family separated from that child and family. Similar to what we heard about in the early session, the keynote speaker, we really want that child and that family to be working together, that family to become that expert. They're the ones that know that child better than the therapist that comes in once a week for an hour. This is the list of the required early start services in the federal mandate. I think there are 16 services, and we are able to provide these services based on assessment and need. I won't read the list to you, but some of the services that we provide the ones that we provide most often, speech therapy, occupational therapy, physical therapy. We provide transportation for families to and from early intervention services. Respite used to be an early intervention service that we provided at the regional center. It is not a required early start service, so we do not provide that to our early intervention consumers any longer. The only time we can provide respite is if it's in order for that family to access an early intervention service for a short term. But that list is pretty extensive. One of the changes that also came about in 2009, we've had a lot in early start, so we're all kind of adapting to the changes and figuring out how we're going to move forward. But the state of California now requires families to access their private insurance for the funding of early start services. And that's been a challenge for us because up until 2009, we have provided the services without question. The family did not have to use their private insurance. So this has been a big shift for the community, for our families, and for our staff at the regional center. We do, in early intervention, recognize that services need to be provided in a timely manner. So if a family is looking to pursue their insurance, they're not hearing back from their insurance company, or they're having difficulty with that process, we will provide that early intervention service while that family continues through that process. We don't want to delay services with this new requirement. We know that we have a very short window to work with these kids, and we don't want to delay that while they're pursuing this piece of the new legislation. Once services are denied, if a private insurance is unable to provide it, the regional center will fund the service as well. The other piece that is important for folks to know is private insurance is not required when a child is first referred to the regional center for assessments and evaluations. So there is no roadblock to sending them for that initial evaluation and assessment piece. The plan that we develop with our families, our service coordinators when working with those families, is called the Individualized Family Service Plan, or the IFSP. And it is a written document that includes the family, the service coordinator, and also any of the other assessors, providers who helped with assessing that child in their areas of development. It looks at that child's strengths and abilities. It also talks to the family about what their concerns are, what they want for their child, what would they like them to do, and what would they like to do as a family together with that child. It also then will identify what the services will be, what the outcomes will be for that family and for that child. And the IFSP, there are timelines for the IFSP. From the date of the initial referral that someone might call in a referral to the regional center, we have 45 days from the date of the referral, those are calendar days, so it goes very fast, to do evaluation and assessment and determine eligibility and to complete the individualized family service plan. The IFSP will get reviewed at 6 months. We call that a periodic review of the IFSP. And then the IFSP is written again annually. And another big timeline for the IFSP is at 30 months of age, we begin transitioning that child from early intervention to preschool services. And that could be the special education preschool services. It could be Head Start. It could be community programs. But we are working with families as early as 30 months, if not earlier, to help them to get ready for what's going to happen when my child turns 3 and is no longer participating in the Early Start program. As I mentioned, it is part of the mandate that we transition our kids to preschool, and I already mentioned some of those things. One of the big changes in 2009 was the high-risk infant category was eliminated from Early Start. And these are our, typically the kids that fell into that category were those babies that are born prematurely, low birth weight, medically fragile, usually came to us from the neonatal intensive care units. That category of eligibility was eliminated from Early Start. And we now have a new program in California called the Prevention Resources and Referral Services, or PRRS, and Kelly Young from Warmline will talk to you about it in a little bit more detail. But those are where our high-risk kids are now being served and followed. Those kids typically are referred to our family resource centers through the regional center. So we still want the referrals to come through the regional center. We determine whether they're eligible for the Early Start program. If they're not eligible for Early Start, then we will refer them to the PRRS program. So we want to make sure we catch those kids for assessment. This is the criteria for eligibility for the Prevention Resource Referral Services. It is infants and toddlers at risk for developmental delay under the age of 36 months. They have to have two or more high-risk factors, or they have a parent who has a diagnosis of a developmental disability, or they're those kids that don't meet our developmental delay criteria that tightened up in 2009. The children who are 24 to 35 months of age with a developmental delay of 33% to 49%. And then a new category of eligibility for PERS that has been, I think, recently added is a child who may be at risk for autism. So all of those kids could be served by PERS and not the regional center under Early Start. I just wanted to end on what our hope is, because we've had so many changes over the last few years. There's a lot of confusion. We actually had quite a decrease in the number of referrals that came to the regional center. We try to do our best to get out into the community to do presentations, to make sure everyone has the accurate information on who's eligible, who they can refer, who can make a referral. And we want folks in the community to know that you can refer anyone to the regional center in Early Start. We will figure out if they're eligible. We'll let you know if it's an appropriate referral. You're not responsible to try to figure that out, whether they meet all those percentages of delay. We want you to just send them, and we'll weed it out and figure it out. The other message that we hope to send out to our community referring parties is refer as soon as possible. In the past, we sometimes would hear from families that they talked to their pediatrician about a concern, and the pediatrician would say, let's wait till they're a little older and then we'll look at it again. And because our developmental delay criteria has tightened up, we really want you to refer kids as young as possible. Try to get them in the door under 24 months so we can look at the 33% delay category for eligibility instead of 233 or 150%. So refer as early as possible and keep making those referrals.
Ellen did a great job in explaining Early Start and the services through the local education agencies, or LEAs, for Early Start. Are pretty much the same as what Ellen described, but I'm going to highlight just some of the unique aspects of eligibility and services that the LEA provides, and as well as some common practices and partnerships across the early intervention providers. As Ellen mentioned, with Regional Center, also with LEAs, anyone can refer. And what we've worked out in the Placer County Infant Program with Regional Center has worked really well, in that whether a referral goes into Regional Center or into the Placer County Office of Education Infant Program, our agencies will decide who can take the referral, and we partner on so many of the referrals where we co-enroll and the children are duly served. The LEAs are responsible for infants and toddlers with solely low-incidence disabilities, which are vision impairment, hearing impairment, severe orthopedic impairment, or any combination. So this is unique to the LEAs. Their funding is provided through the State Department of Education. And then the LEAs also have the responsibility to provide other services to other children with developmental delays or establish risk up to the funded capacity. And this is a number set by the State Department of Education to each LEA as far as the number of families that they would be providing services to. And in some of the LEAs, there are enough children with solely low incidence diagnosis or disabilities that that's all they provide. In some of the other LEAs, there are many more families that can be provided services to. So for our program, we usually see about 40 children that have solely low incidence disabilities, and then we see another 50 with other delays or established risk. And then, as I mentioned, referrals are often made to the LEAs and Regional Center to duly serve. And in our infant program, and I think fairly common across the state for LEA programs, is LEA programs are also vendorized by Regional Center as one of the providers. So it can become very complicated to a family or a public health nurse or a physician as who to refer to. Is the LEA under their funded capacity? Do they only take solely low-incidence children, or do they take all children? And I think the collaborative efforts and the kind of seamless referral process has really kind of taken that away from those questions that the people wanting to make referrals make. Another difference for the LEAs currently is eligibility. Our current education code defines developmental delay differently than early start definition, so that the current definition is that children need to require intensive special education services, but the difference here is functioning at or below 50% of the chronological age in one skill area, or between 51% and 75% in any two developmental areas. So there is proposal to through the State Department of Education to align the eligibility criteria with Early Start eligibility, but that is still in process. So it's actually still a nice opportunity to be able to serve children that have 25% delays in their development, and that's another nice partnership system that we have in place, that if children are evaluated by regional center and do not meet the one area of 33% delay if they're under 24 months, often they will have two areas of 25% delay through the LEA. So we're able to still provide a lot of services to children that fall under the State Department of Education Ed Code eligibility definition right now. We also provide children services that for in the established risk condition, and the solely low incidence children are a category in established risk. So the LEAs provide the services, and they're actually the responsible agency and the payer of last resort for the children with solely low incidence disabilities, and then the regional centers are the payer of last resort for all other children. The LEAs use the same early start evaluation and assessment procedures that Ellen talked about, and we use multidisciplinary teams. We assess in all five developmental domains. We use parent report, clinical opinion, and do family assessments. In the provision that clinical opinion is part of the assessment and eligibility process also provides a great opportunity if children are missing their developmental delay criteria just a little bit to qualify them, but there are very significant clinical opinion factors, then the IFSP process allows the assessors to use the clinical opinion to establish eligibility. And then LEAs also utilize personnel specific to the solely low incidence disabilities, which part is part of Ed Code, in that if you are suspecting solely low incidence disability, or it's established that you have solely low incidence disabilities, the personnel that are credentialed or licensed in that area would then be a part of the assessment team as well as the service team. So we have vision teachers, deaf and hard of hearing teachers, OI specialists, other staff that LEAs employ are occupational therapists, physical therapists, speech therapists. Many have infant, family, and mental health specialists, nurses, some nutritionists. I think, again, in the assessment process, it's a partnership, collaboration. If the regional center is involved in providing services or establishing eligibility, public health nurses, any of the other community agencies, we provide an assessment plan to the family of who is going to participate in providing the assessments. Sometimes when regional center is going to be the primary service provider and our program would be a vendor, regional center also might ask us to provide an assessment from our deaf and hard of hearing teacher or a vision specialist, even though it's not going to be a solely low incidence child. We have the same responsibilities of the required early intervention services, as Ellen talked about, the 16 services, for any of the children that we serve. And then we are the sole responsibility, have sole responsibility for the children with the solely low incidence disabilities. And this includes the same staffing that I had talked about, and must include vision and DHH staff, deaf and hard of hearing staff. And again, the LEAs and the Regional Center for the dually eligible children will decide who's going to provide what services for which children. So again, it's a very collaborative effort. Part C, which is the Individuals for Disabilities Education Act, IEDA Part C, mission, and this was set forth by the Office, Federal Office of Special Education Programs Natural Environment Work Group, I think did a wonderful job in kind of stating what we've been talking about all morning so far, as far as the mission of early intervention is to build upon and provide supports and resources to assist the family members and caregivers to enhance their children's learning and development through everyday learning opportunities. And then two of the primary service goals is to enhance the development of infants and toddlers with disabilities and to enhance the capacity of the families to meet the special needs of the infants and toddlers. So the focus is to assist the parent to understand their child's development and then how to help their child's development. And as Dr. Nowicki was talking about too, is kind of look at some of those other risk and protective factors that you can really help the family with. I think back to the service goals and the mission too, is there's really been a paradigm shift over the last 10 years or so to really shift from looking at early intervention services or services to this young population from a treatment and deficit model to a capacity building, strength-based, resource-based, and family-centered model. So some of the common service principles and practices shared across early intervention providers is to be family-centered, and that's in assessment and services within the context of the family, their values, their routines, their beliefs, how they view their child, who they define as the important individuals in their child's life and family, and focusing on assisting the parent to understand their child's development and how they can promote their child's development. And then relationship-based is what we were talking about earlier, is learning does take place in the context of the family, and the family is a great organizer of development, and the quality of development is affected by the quality of relationships. And one of the main goals is to increase the capacity in the family or increase their confidence and competence in what they want for their child, and that they are pivotal people to facilitate that. And then service are to be in the natural environment. We've talked a little bit about that, engaging the families and children in their interests, their natural learning opportunities, activities that they already do, what they do all day, and the service providers are the coaches and the providers of information, again, on how the families can support the children. Services are usually developmentally appropriate. We look at acknowledging that the different developmental domains are interrelated. They proceed from to greater complexity. Early experiences have profound effects, and children develop best when they have secure, consistent relationships with responsive adults, which is part of the intervention that we would be providing in really focusing and paying close attention to supporting that parent-child interaction, and again, how the parent is engaging with the family. The services are strength-based. We build and scaffold on current strengths to help access new skills. And the parallel process, how we are, is important as who we are. And these are Jeri Paul's quotes. And how we are with each other as professionals is how we would want parents to be with their children. And then do unto others as we'd have others do unto others. So this is the concept of really being able to model and coach families with that relationship-based approach of what we know works with the interaction between the parent and child. And then they would need to be culturally relevant, that we would want to respect and follow the lead of the family's values and beliefs. And then I think it was mentioned earlier today, the importance of partnerships, especially as funds narrow and tighten. And it also is so important to look at the multidisciplinary service provision in an assessment, in that different disciplines bring different strengths and lenses of to how to view the child and the family. And the collaboration of different disciplines, whether it's within a program or across the community or even across the state or the nation, I think is really valuable when you're looking at what the parent has defined as far as the support that they need, what's working well, what they need help with, what are their challenges, and then who and how could provide those opportunities. So in Placer County, we partner with anyone and everyone we can, both in referrals, assessment, and services, and try to individualize it also on top of that to what the parent is saying that they want support with or that's already working well with them for them. So the Placer Infant Program and the Family Resource Center have a partnership to partner on each one of our activities. The Family Resource Center attends our some of our play groups, and it's a great opportunity then for our families to meet Family Resource Center and then hopefully enhance their participation with Family Resource Center. We encourage our families to participate in the Family Resource Center activities for the same reason. And then since the Family Resource Centers are a great resource now for the children that did not meet the eligibility criteria that Ellen was talking about for Early Start and are going to be followed by prevention services, our program wants to be able to extend the invitation to the prevention families to be able to participate in our playgroups. We have community playgroups. And then Regional Center and the LEAs jointly process children for eligibility, assessment, services. We participate in the IFSP meetings and shared service and just kind of decide who's going to provide what. We do a lot of services out in the community, just wherever the child is, and also have play groups that are through more formalized partnerships, such as with Early Head Start, some of the other preschools, and library activities. And the healthcare providers, we co-process referrals and assessments and provide services with our public health nurses. We have quite a few pediatricians in the area that are very involved with the referrals and checking in to how services are going and how to have conversations with the families. And then as Ellen mentioned, we also have the responsibility to provide a seamless transition with our school districts when children are approaching that 2.5 age range.
I'm Kelly Young, and I'm from Warmline Family Resource Center. I'm the executive director. We'll get to our next slide. Here is our website and our phone number. It's a 1-800 number. I'm going to show it to you at the end, too. But to start off with, I want you to know that our services are available to all families and to the professionals that serve them. The goal of the Early Start Family Resource Centers is to provide families with parent-to-parent support that enhances their child's ability to support their child's development. I think the Early Start law is an amazing law because it is family-centered, not child-centered, so it supports the whole family. And those first couple of years are so important for a child, and one of the most important elements of that child's development is the family. So in creating this Early Start in California, the legislature recognized that parent-to-parent support strengthens families' ability to fully participate in service planning and the capacity to care for their child. So we are that element of Early Start. We're here to support the parents. There's 47 Early Start Family Resource Centers in California, and so every single region in California is served by a Family Resource Center. You can go on the website, to check out what Family Resource Center serves your families and your children. And there's a couple different general areas that all Early Start Family Resource Centers in California serve. We all provide parent-to-parent support, and I'll go over that a little bit later, the importance of that. We provide parents with resources and referrals, and that looks different in every locale. And anytime a parent needs anything, if we don't know the answer, we will find the answer. So at Warmline, we have a couple publications that we have. We have a local directory that has phone numbers that are most asked for parents. We also have a couple other publications. And then if a parent needs a play group or they want to access the local parks and recreation, we have that information for them, and we have relationships with those agencies also. We also do parent professional collaboration. I'm really proud of the collaboration that we have with our LEAs in the regional center, and we continue to work together to improve the system, to make it work better, and for all of us to provide our perspective so that we understand which each what each contribute. Again, we do transition from early start, really important, and with our partners, we try to make that transition very smooth for our families. We provide education, we do workshops on transitioning, and we also have a publication called Turning Three that we provide to families to help them understand the difference between early start and if their child is moving into special education or has graduated and they're caught up and they're doing fine now, just some of the services that are available. And of course, the law enumerated that we give support for low incidence, and they are a part of Early Start, so of course we give them the same support that we give all families. And then each Early Start Family Resource Center, because they're in different parts of California, look a little bit different. They look at their community and see the needs that they have and will develop services for those needs. A lot of the Family Resource Centers also have other grants, so it expands their services. Warmline has a First Five grant up in Placer County, so we have an office up there. We're able to offer a lot more services in Placer because of that grant. I think what's really unique about the Early Start Family Resource Center is that we are staffed by parents, so we have a shared common experience of parenting a child with special needs or with a disability, so we understand where our families are coming from. We have the specific knowledge and experience because we have traveled the same road with them. And again, that collaboration with our partners, I think, is really important to make this system really work. We all have to work together. Warmline is in six counties. So we are in Sacramento, Yolo, Placer, El Dorado, Nevada, and Alpine. The Beach Center did a survey a few years back, quite a few now, about parent-to-parent support, and 80% of parents find that parent-to-parent support was helpful. And I think it's one of the most important things that we provide is the parent-to-parent support. And I think some people don't really understand the importance of it. So I think when you have a child, a typical child, you have this natural support system. You have your family and friends who have had experience raising a child, and when things come up for you, you have somebody you can call. When you have a child with a disability or special needs, those supports aren't always adequate, and so you become a little bit more isolated, more fearful, and you need somebody who understands where you're coming from. You need somebody who can tell you, yes, I understand that. That happened to me. So that support, I think, is one of the most important things that we provide to our families. When they changed the eligibility, I think the state, again, recognized that let's give something to these families, and they looked at the Early Start Family Resource Centers and saw that we were already providing these wonderful services. So they gave us the opportunity to give the same services that we give to our Early Start families, but it's kind of expanded, it's enhanced. So this is a no-cost service to families. We provide a lot of the same information and resources that we apply to the Early Start families, but we know that some of these kids don't have the same concerns, so we look more at the typical development of the child. We try to educate the families on looking for the warning signs in case their children do start falling behind a little bit. We can re-refer them back to the regional center to get an assessment again to see if they now qualify for Early Start. We follow up with them all the time. We call them quarterly, so we try to stay in contact with them. We have the same conversations that Steve was talking about of, like, you know, brag about your kid, how are they doing, and we listen to find out if there's any concerns. And also, we talk to them to find out what kinds of things they might want to access, whether it's going to a playgroup or showing them all the great resources that we have in the community. We do outreach, so we go and talk to the hospitals. We talk to, when we go to the Mind Institute, we have a table here. So we're constantly talking to the community, not only about PERS, but Early Start and disability awareness in general. So some of the other things that we do for PERS is we have, and I have a bag over here, we've created a nice bag, kind of a gift bag for them. We use the First Five New Parent Box, which is a wonderful resource and is available throughout California to any family. And then we've added a few things. We've added a gas card, which most families love, and we've added some nice things, a little book that they can put their kid's picture in, a developmental chart that shows their height too, and it kind of gives them where their child should be at developmentally. So, and then we're working to provide other things too, such as baby massage and play groups for their children. We want parents to engage in their children and to have a strong bond with their child. We also want to encourage our parents to play with their children. Sometimes us parents get so caught up in trying to fix things and try to make things better that we forget that the most important thing we can do is just relax and play with our kiddos. One of the points I want to make too is Warmline, even though we're funded birth to three and birth to five up in Placer, we serve all families regardless of age or disability, and we also serve all of the professionals that serve them. If you have any questions at all about anything, we want you to access our services. And I think the one thing I want to stress too is that it is our goal that all families be included in the community and that the labels disappear, and that we see each individual as unique and look at their strengths, not their weaknesses. And we support all families in accessing those community resources and the community activities and being a full member in the community.
The UC Davis Mind Institute was created in 1998 with a promise to find cures for neurodevelopmental disorders. Every day, our physicians and researchers come closer to fulfilling that promise. Their groundbreaking research on autism, Fragile X syndrome, chromosome 22q11.2 deletion syndrome, ADHD, and other brain disorders are helping children achieve their fullest potential. Please visit our website to find out more about current studies, upcoming events, and how you can help make a difference.
You've been listening to a podcast by University of California Television. For more information about this program or UCTV, visit us online at uctv.tv.